Well, good morning and welcome to Cornerstone Church Sunday morning service. Let's turn to 2 Kings chapter 15, 2 Kings chapter 15, and we want to return to our study on the kings of Israel and Judah. Now, the focus of this section that you read earlier was on six kings of the northern kingdom of Israel. If you remember, the split happened under Rehoboam. 10 tribes joined together in a rebel kingdom, a rival kingdom called the Kingdom of Israel, or sometimes called the Kingdom of Ephraim, the northern kingdom. And then 2 tribes remained loyal to the descendants of King David of Judah and Benjamin, and they formed the Kingdom of Judah. So today we go back to the last part really of the history of the Kingdom of Israel, because we're very near the end when this kingdom is going to be destroyed and will never be resurrected again. It'll be just completely wiped out under the Assyrian exile. Now, it's truly a tale of sin and devastation. And in this little section, we have a 5/6 kings, because it really ends with Hosea, who we will talk about, the last ruler in 2 Kings 17 in a couple of weeks' time. But the focus really is in these 5 of the last 6 kings. And their names are Zechariah, Shalom, Menahem, Pekahiah, Pekah, and Hosea. And none of them are good. In fact, it's hard sometimes to pick the worst one. All of them are thoroughly depraved and wicked. And many of these kings really are kind of fake kings. They just murder the previous guy and seize the throne. And only one of them will die a natural death. All the others will murder each other. For instance, Shalom will murder Zechariah. Pekahiah will murder Menahem. Pekah will murder Pekahiah. And then Hosea will come along and murder Pekah. So it's really an unedifying tale of intrigue, corruption, murder, chaos, confusion, instability. And the nation is just rocking. It's destroying itself. It's imploding from within. And the nation is tottering on the brink of ruin. And sad to say, it doesn't see it. It's just caught up in this maelstrom of destruction. And it's hard to believe when you read 2 Kings chapter 15 that this is the holy nation of Israel. These are the people that God said were to be the light to the Gentiles, the light to the pagans, to show them what it is to have a nation under God and God's rule. But instead, they became as bad as, if not worse, than the pagan Gentile nations around them. And when a nation turns its back on God, when a company, when a church, when a society, when even a continent turns its back on God, God abandons them and gives them leaders after their own desires and after their own godly ways. And you're really going to see that illustrated in these kings. And the first one we run into is a man called Zechariah. Now, there are many Zechariahs in the Bible, and it's a good name. It means Jehovah remembers. God, the covenant God of Israel, is faithful to remember his people. And although he has a good name, he's not a good person. And really, we're just told in the brief extract of his life, just 4 key things about this man, Zechariah. We're told, for number one, he's the son of Jeroboam II, and he reigns over Israel in Samaria 6 months. So we're told his pedigree. He's the son of Jeroboam II, really the great grandson of Jehu, of that dynasty that destroyed the dynasty of Ahab and Jezebel. Jehu took it over, if you remember. And from Jehu, God promised 4 kings would come, 4 generations. And this man, Zechariah, is number 4. He's the last of the promised kings to emerge from Jehu. So he's the great grandson of Jehu. That's the first thing. Then the second thing we discover about him, he did evil following the sins of Jeroboam. It says he did that which was evil, verse 9, in the sight of the Lord, as his fathers had done. He departed not from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. So he just followed on like Jeroboam. And if you remember, Jeroboam did two things. He promoted idolatry and he participated in idolatry by mixing the true religion of worshiping Jehovah with false religion. And he created his own new religion in order to control the people in the nation of Israel. And this man, Zechariah, follows on in the same evil and wicked way. The third thing we learn about him is he reigned just 6 months. Very, very short time. Half a year. And then the fourth thing we read about him, he was murdered by one of his own military leaders, a man called Shallum, the son of Jabesh, verse 10, conspired against him and smote him before the people and slew him and reigned in his stead. Now, the fact it says he was murdered before the people may well suggest that he did so with the approval of the people in Samaria. They were maybe upset with Zechariah, a weak playboy-type leader, not the man of his father who brought prosperity and power back to the nation. But this man was wicked. This man didn't appear to bring anything of success to the nation. And one of his rivals within the nation rose up and murdered him after just 6 months. Now, if you notice the contrast with his ancestors, Jehu reigns 28 years. His grandfather Jehoahaz reigns 17 years. His father Jeroboam reigns 41 years. And this man just reigns 6 months. He's a very poor imitation of the generations before him. And you really got to say, when you read his little biography, what a wasted life. And sad to say, what a terrible way to die. He lived a terrible life. He suffered a terrible death. And he now faces a terrible eternity. Nothing good to say about Zechariah. But then the second king that comes along, who just seizes the throne by murder, is this man Shallum. And Shallum was noted for even less in the Word of God, because we're told he reigns for just a month in Samaria. So clearly, he didn't have the approval of everybody in murdering Zechariah, because within 1 month, someone came along, a military commander, Menahem, from the army, and murdered him. Now, this really is a mess. First guy reigns 6 months, murdered. New guy takes over, reigns 4 weeks, murdered. But you have to say, your mind is drawn to Proverbs 26, verse 27, when you read of what happens to this man Shallum, because it says in Proverbs 26, verse 27, "Whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him." It certainly applies to him, that Proverbs. He reaped what he sowed, and God often allows that to happen in this life, that a person who sows evil in the lives of others reaps it in his own life. We think of Absalom, sought to seize the throne and murder his own father, and in the end he was murdered. And he was humiliated and murdered in a most shameful way. We think of Haman, the proud playboy prince of the Persian Empire, and how he conspired to have Mordecai hung on the great gallows and the Jews to be destroyed. And what happened was he was hung on the gallows. He built for others. And one of the lessons you learn in life, one of the principles in life, is those who seek and grasp after power are often left powerless themselves. I think it was Shakespeare who said, "Uneasy is the head who wears the crown." And it's certainly true here in the ungodly world. And one thing that's noticeable as you read this chapter is there's nobody in Israel seeking God for a leader. There's no leadership within the elders of the nation saying, "We need a man of God to lead us. We need another King David to lead us." And of course, Israel is in such a state of disobedience that nobody's seeking God's help, God's wisdom, God's intervention in this situation. Now, the next guy who takes over, Menahem, takes over at a time of great chaos and uncertainty. There had now, listen to this, there had now been four kings in a period of 8 months. You had Zechariah, then he died. Then you had his son, this man, this father of Zechariah, this man Jeroboam, he died. Then Zechariah took over, reigned 6 months, he was murdered. Then this man Shalom took over, lasted a month, he was murdered. And now we have Menahem. So you just see a nation that's just teetering at the brink of total collapse. Now, Menahem is from the military. We're told that very specifically, that this man was a military man. And we're told not just here, but in 2 Chronicles. And he uses the power of the military. It's almost like a military coup here. He's like a general who's decided to have a coup d'etat and take over the nation. And he takes over this nation using the power of the military. And he becomes a man who will consolidate power. In fact, he's going to be the only one, really, who will die a natural death and reign a significant period of time. Now, how did he manage to reign over the nation? If you go to verse 16, we're told, "Then Menahem smote Tiphathah and all that were therein, and the coast thereof from Tirzah, because they opened not to him, therefore he smote it, and all the women therein that were with child he ripped up." So Menahem was a military man. He understood the sword. He used it to murder his predecessor. And then having murdered him, he uses the sword to control the nation. And he does so in a very bloodthirsty and ruthless way. In fact, we don't read this of any other king before him who would go to other fellow Jews and, when they wouldn't submit to his authority, would just butcher them to death. Even the pregnant woman, just butcher them with the sword, so much so that the child within their womb would be ripped to pieces. This is the first time we're reading of such barbaric behavior by Israelites to Israelites. Now, we've heard of pagan nations behaving this way. Hazael was described as being such a king. But we've never heard up to this point that a fellow Jew would do this to another Jew. And yet it's happening. And it's happening from the top of the nation to the bottom of the nation. And Menahem was a man who believed in terrifying other people. He was a tin pot dictator. He was Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, Mao Zedong. He had all those weapons of fear and bloodthirstiness and ruthlessness that he used to control the nation of Israel. In fact, he reminds me a little bit of Genghis Khan. When Genghis Khan would go to a city that opposed him or refused to submit to him, he famously used his yurts or tents to send a message. And on the first day, he would put out a white tent, and the white tent would tell them that if they surrendered immediately to him, unconditionally to him, their lives would be spared. Well, if they didn't surrender after a short period of time, maybe a day or a couple of days, he put up then what's called a red tent or a red yurt. And the red yurt says that if you surrender now, I'll kill all the men in the city only, but not the women and children. And if they didn't surrender at that point, then the next day, Genghis Khan ordered the black tent to be put up outside a city. And the black tent symbolized this, that everybody was going to be massacred in the city. And when he eventually conquered, and he had conquered almost every city he laid under siege, he would massacre every single one, men, women, and children. And he believed that using this method of absolute terror and using the symbols of the various tent colors or yurt colors, other cities then would hear the story and be terrified into submission. And before he would even arrive, they would have decided, as soon as the white tent goes up, we're going to surrender. And really, that's what's going on here with this man, Menahem. When he discovers an area of Israel that refuses to accept his reign as the one who murdered the previous king and took over the previous crown and the previous throne, he went out and he just massacred everybody, including the women, the pregnant women, in a most barbaric way. And what he's saying is, don't try to stand in my way. Don't try to be disloyal. Don't try to play games with me. And really, it shows the depth of the brutality of the times and the godlessness of the times. King David, the greatest king of Israel, reigned not by fear, but by love and service of the people, by his sacrificial heart, by his love for his nation, by having the heart of a shepherd for the sheep of Israel, by being a just man and a generous man, a man who would lead them in battle against their enemies, a man who would sacrifice his life for their life. But now we have rulers in Israel, and the only weapons they have to control the nation is barbarity, ruthlessness, murder, and bloodshed. Now, the problem with ruling in such a way and being a bully is eventually a bigger bully will come along. And in verse 19, we're told God allows a bigger bully to come alongside the nation of Israel, a man called Pul, the king of Assyria, up near where we have modern day Iraq. And the Assyrian Empire was rising at this time, and this man Tiglath-Pileser, or his shorter name, Pul, comes along at this point, and he says to the king of Israel, I'm a bigger bully than you, and if you don't surrender to me, I'm going to do what you did to the people at Tipsah. Well, Menahem is good bullying women and children, but he's not such a courageous man when he faces the king of Assyria, because we're told he began to pay him 1,000 talents of silver. Now, the Assyrian policy at this time, they were famously a very barbaric people, the Assyrians. But they were also a people that were a pragmatic people. So they had a policy in place that if a kingdom surrendered to them, or a group of kingdoms, they wouldn't destroy them. They would leave them as a tributary nation to pay tax to them, and leave one of their own or a group of their own people to be co-rulers or to be spies in the royal palace. And Menahem pays about 37 tons of silver across to Pul in order to allow him to stay on the throne as really a puppet king of the nation of Israel. And part of the agreement was that not only would he not rebel against Pul and pay him this money, but he would support him as king and honor him. Now, where did he get the money? Well, we're told, verse 20 of 1 Kings 15, and Menahem exacted the money of Israel, even of all the mighty men of wealth, of each man 50 shekels of silver, to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and stayed not there in the land. So he didn't get the money from his own savings, from the king's treasury. He went around the nation and basically exacted a wealth tax on the wealthiest of the nation and took their silver, took their wealth to pay off the king of Assyria and to keep himself in power. Now, if you read the minor prophets, Amos, Hosea, and Joel, you'll discover at this time that one of the things they spoke out particularly against the nation of Israel was how there was this wealthy elite class who had become wealthy by being corrupt, by oppressing the poor, not paying proper wages, stealing from the poor, taking advantage of the poor, paying bribes to the judiciary when the cases would be brought to court. And Joel and Amos and Hosea and all the other minor prophets, they prophesied very strongly against us. And they said, God's going to judge you. And God's going to make you reap what you sow. And part of that reaping what they're sowing happens here, because Menahem is used by God to be an instrument of judgment upon these wealthy elites, and they're going to have to pay out from their ill-gotten gains to pay off the king of Assyria. Now, the king of Assyria didn't hang around. As I said, he went on to fight other, he had other battles on the eastern part of his empire and the southernmost parts of his empire. So when this part was stable, the western part that bordered the land of Israel, he left them alone. And of course, out of sight, out of mind, other people began to say, well, this is not good. We don't like paying this money. This man's not that strong. We can defend our own borders. We shouldn't be paying this. And clearly there arose some type of discontentment in the nation, particularly those on the other side of the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan, that bordered now the empire of Assyria. They resented this. And although they were too afraid to attack Menahem himself, he had enough control and power within the nation, that anger, that discontentment against Assyria and against the family of Menahem for making them pay this money is going to bubble over after the death of Menahem, because Menahem dies a natural death. Did he deserve to die by assassination? Absolutely. You wonder as you read it, why did God allow this man even to reign so long? He took another man's life. He deserved to have his own life taken, but God has his own ways and he'll catch up with Menahem in eternity. But when Menahem dies, we're told Pekahiah, his son, takes over in his stead. Verse 23. And this man will only reign 2 years. His father will reign quite a few years. I think it's 10 years. But this man, Pekahiah, his reign will be very unstable. Although it will look like there's a peaceful handover of power for the very first time between Menahem to Pekahiah, no assassinations. A new dynasty is now stabilizing. Although it looks good, appearances are deceiving. Because just 2 years into his reign, a man called Pekah, and it was a wicked reign, we're told in verse 25, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, a captain of his, another military man, comes in to the palace in Samaria, and he conspired against him and smote him with Argob and Ari, and with him 50 men of the Gileadites, and he killed him and reigned in his stead. Now, the geography of this is a little bit interesting. We'll put the map on the screen. This man, Pekah, is a military leader, and he surrounds himself with two other powerful military men, and 50 men from Gilead, i.e. from the east side of the Jordan, the area that borders Assyria, the area that's most under threat from the Assyrians, and no doubt the area that faces the most humiliation from any Assyrian incursions at that time along the border. And they're not happy with the policy of appeasement, paying off these Assyrians and pull the king of Assyria. And somehow they manipulate the situation and go to the royal palace and murder this man, Pekahiah. So Pekah, a little bit confusing, murders Pekahiah and seizes the throne. No doubt they think they know better, that they can break this tribute link with Assyria. They can be self-governing, free and independent nation again, and that they can turn up, wave their fist at the great Assyrian king Pul. Maybe they're underestimating him. They think he's not powerful, or he'll be too busy in other parts of the empire. Well, this is a big mistake, because we read that this man, the rest of the acts of Pekahiah, but then in verse 27, in the 22nd year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, began to reign over Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 20 years. And he did that which is evil, same as the rest. But then in verse 29, here's where it gets interesting. It says, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, so that's Pul, P-U-L. And he took this place called Ijon, Abel-Beth-Maacah, Janoah, and Kedesh and Hazor and Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and carried them captive to Assyria. Now, what happens here? If you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 26 and do the comparison here with the language used, we get a clearer explanation. Because 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 26 says, "And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tigal-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away." And here's the group of people that are carried away: even the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half tribe of Manasseh, and brought them unto Halah and Habor and Hara and to the river Gosan until this day. So what happened? Those Israelites from the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, that were on the east side of the Jordan, that borders the land of Assyria, the empire of Assyria, when Tiglath-Pileser heard of this rebellion, he came sweeping down with some of his soldiers and swept away all those Israelites on the east side. Now, if you remember, it was the men of Gilead who murdered the previous king, who was pro-Assyrian, this man, Pekahiah. So now they're reaping what they sowed. But more importantly is this point. If you remember way back in the history of the nation, when Moses was leading the children of Israel to the border of the promised land, when they arrived on the east side, the Reubenites and the Gadites and half the tribe of Manasseh said, "Let us stay on the east side, the more fertile side. We don't want to go across with the other Israelites into the promised land. We want to stay here." Moses scolded them for their lack of faith and lack of desire to go across into the promised land itself. And by staying on the east side of the River Jordan, they not only were the first to go into idolatry and then immorality and apostasy as a people, those on the east side, they are more closely influenced by the pagan nations on their borders. But when the Assyrians swept in, they were the first ones to face God's judgment at the point of the sword. They were the first exiles of the children of Israel, the first free Jews, free Hebrews, to now become slaves forever. Now, we're coming now to the end of the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom. After Pekah takes the throne and reigns for a period of time and begins to lose his land, this evil man is murdered by Hoshea. We'll see that and how that plays out in the final king's reign in 1 Kings chapter 17, as I said, in a couple of weeks. But what lessons do we want to learn from reading? And I know these names are a little bit confusing, and I know they come quick and fast. But really, what lessons does God want you and I to learn from this story and the incidences in this story? Number one, here's the first lesson. You see the musical thrones. In fact, I give the title of today's message, Musical Thrones. And you see this principle. When a society, when a nation, when a church, when a family, even when an individual abandons God, then chaos and confusion erupts. That's always the way. The nations, the people that abandon God are abandoned then by Him. And that brings all kinds of problems and difficulties and challenges into the nation. Of course, when the opposite is true, when God is honored in a home, when God is honored in a church, when God is honored in a company, a business, when God is honored in a society, then you see stability. Then you see blessing. Yes, Satan will try to come in and sow the tares among the wheat and try to bring turbulence in amongst the group of people there. But by and large, you'll see if the leadership is strong and clear and certain, then you'll discover their stability and peace. And no confusion will not be the order of the day, will not be the key component. And you know, you're seeing that really in the West today. If you switch on your news, You see all these former Christian nations from Canada and the United States and UK and Western Europe, and you see the chaos that reigns. You see the leaders, how pathetic they are, how weak they are, how intellectually incapable they are. Some of them are so badly dressed even compared to many other nations, and how nations at least to look up to these nations and fear these nations and even admire these nations for their stability and for their good leadership and their values and their democracies and their laws. They're now looking from the other side of the world and shaking their heads and saying, what has become of you? What kind of a mess have you become? And all these ineffective, weak, ungodly leaders are now dominating in these places. And they're just coming and going. There's so much instability. And you're seeing every day, aren't you, instability in the world. And nations are rising against nations, challenging one another. It wasn't long ago there was a crisis at Taiwan, and then there was a crisis at the border with India and China, and then there was one with the United States and China, and now we're back to the Ukraine one. And it just never seems to end, does it? One after the other. A world of confusion, a world that has abandoned God, is filled with chaos and disorder. And that's what you see played out, not just in this chapter, but in the world around us. But then the second thing you see is this. Wicked leaders, and it's really linked to what I've just said, wicked leaders are part of God's judgment. When God destroys a nation, he gives it leaders to destroy it. When people want to turn away from God and want leaders to guide them to turn away from God, God often will give them what they want. If you remember, King Saul came to the throne when the nation of Israel said, we want a king like all the other nations. We don't want a king after God's own heart, because God had already prepared a man in time to come called David to be that king, the first king. But they said, no, we don't want to wait. We want a king like all the other nations, not a spiritual one, but a military one, a one who physically is impressive to lead us out to battle. And God said, okay, I'll give you one like that. And he gave them the tallest man in the nation, Saul. He gave them a man from the warrior tribe, King Saul, Benjamite. A man who was a mighty man of valor. A man who came from a powerful family in Israel. And God gave them the best of the flesh. And they discovered, to their horror, that when God gave them what they wanted, it's not what they needed. And God often does that. He gives wicked leaders to a nation. He does it to churches. He does it to homes. He does it to societies. He does it to continents. And you see in this nation of Israel, the corruption begins from the head downwards. Who's the problem? The king. But then where does the problems unfold? From the people. The cancer of sin and corruption starts in the mind and the heart of the king, flows downwards into the people. Then the people rise up and someone murders that king, seizes the throne, and he institutes another reign of corruption and sin from the top downwards. And then from the bottom again, another movement comes, and it's just rebellion, revolution, turmoil, disruption, chaos over and over again. And really, by the time this nation is totally destroyed by the Assyrians, they had first destroyed themselves, hadn't they? But then the third lesson we learn from this chapter is this. Sin never pays. The wages of sin is death, the Bible says. It's not ambiguous. Sin has wages. And really this chapter is one long spectacle, awful spectacle, of sin after sin after sin through the lives of many different individuals, and then the consequences of that sin, the wages of that sin being paid. And you see that over and over and over again. And really what God's saying to you and I is, don't mess with me. Don't mess with me. In Galatians, he says this, do not be deceived. Don't deceive yourselves. The Apostle Paul said, speaking by under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, Be not deceived. God is not mocked. You can't fool God. You might fool yourself. You might fool your neighbor. But you won't fool him. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. If a society, if a church, if an individual, if a family sows the seeds of sins, they're going to have a harvest of sin in their lives. You know, if you sow potatoes into your soil, you're not going to reap a harvest of corn. You're not going to come at the harvest time and discover there are tomatoes growing from the seed of the potatoes. Doesn't work that way. You sow potatoes, you'll get the potatoes. You sow the tomatoes, you'll get the tomatoes. And likewise, just as it is in the natural world, so it is in the spiritual world. God says, don't deceive yourself. Don't kid yourself. Don't bluff yourself. If you sow the seeds of sin and compromise and wickedness and deception in your life, expect to reap that harvest down the road. But then, as part of that, you notice how insignificant these people are. You know, we tend to see these kings and these elites in this story, and even in our own lives, the powerful rulers of today, as very significant people. But you know, every tombstone, every graveyard around the world is a very stark testimony in a little stone engraving that that person's not really very powerful. That person who appeared in their generation to be significant is really not very significant at all. Is a nobody. And most of them, apart from the most notorious, infamous ones, die and are forgotten. And nobody cares about them. Yes, they once were powerful, but not anymore. And you know, sometimes we get intimidated when we look at the ungodly, and particularly the most powerful representatives of the ungodly. And we say, how great they are, how powerful they are. And we're so small and insignificant. And the psalmist said in Psalm 73, really, hang in there. Hang in there. Just wait. Just be patient. Because their end's coming. And they're going nowhere. Just like these kings, Pekah, Pekahiah, and Shalom, and Menahem, and Zechariah. They all looked powerful for a time. But it was just an illusion. They came and they went, and they were forgotten. But then finally, the final lesson we really want to learn from this chapter is this. Man isn't in control. Who is in control? God is in control. Because this chapter is really God telling you and I, don't keep your eyes on men. Men are fickle. Men are fragile. Men are fallible and weak. Men are complacent, and men ultimately come and go. But only God truly is in control. And the fact that these kings rise from nowhere and then are just removed like that is God saying to you and I, I'm sovereign, not them. I'm in control, not them. I mean, even these names, if we were to pick the most powerful name we read today, this man Pul, the king of the Assyrian Empire, who's heard of him today? Apart from a few students of history. Almost nobody in the world knows about this man, cares about this man. He came, he conquered, and then he was conquered, and he died. And God is just saying to you and I, listen, even the most powerful men and the most powerful governments and the most powerful companies and multinational businesses, they're nothing. They're nothing compared to God. Don't get too impressed by them. Don't get too intimidated by them. In fact, just learn to do this. Be still and know that I am God. That's what the psalmist said. Be still. And really that expression, be still, the Hebrew expression there, has the idea, take your hands off the wheel that steers the vehicle. That's what the idea is. And God's saying to you and I, take your hands off the vehicle of your life. Stop trying to force it through. I'm in control. Let me guide. Let me direct your path. And you know, that's hard for us to do because we like to be in control. But God says, no, be still. Let me run. Let me be the shepherd. Let me lead the sheep. King David was a very powerful man. Physically, he was powerful. The psalmist tells us he could break a bow with his hands. He was a great warrior. He could face giants. He led his men into battle and never lost a single battle. He was inspirational. He was handsome. He was a great artist. He could play the harp to an incredible standard. He could compose psalms. A great poet. He was charming. He was generous. He was a wonderful man. And yet in David's life, there were many twists and turns. People befriended him, but then people betrayed him. Some people were loyal to him. Some people turned their backs on him. Some even of his own family betrayed him and tried to murder him, like Absalom. And David, looking over his life, said this about letting God lead and guide and direct his life. He said this in Samuel chapter 22, 2 Samuel 22, verse 31. He says, "As for God, his way is perfect." That's what David wrote at the end of his life. He said, "My way is not perfect. Letting others influence my life will lead me an imperfect way. But you know, if you let God lead your life, he knows best. He's sovereign. He's not just in control of this world. He knows the end from the beginning. He's the all-wise, all-knowing God." And David says, "I have learned that God will never let you down. If you let him rule your life, his way is perfect." And maybe I'm talking to someone today, and you have decisions to make. Let me say this. Let God lead you. Let God lead you. He'll open the right door at the right time. Always will. You can trust him. And if he wants the door opened, nobody on earth will keep it closed. And if he wants the door closed, nobody on earth will be able to open it. And your duty and my duty, is to watch him as he leads you. Be still. Just wait. Let him be sovereign. Let him rule your life. Let him guide your life. And you'll discover if you do that, you'll say like King David at the end of his life, "As for God's way, his way is perfect. His way is perfect." Rather than fight God's will, rather than chaff against it today, my advice to you is simply this. Let God have his way in your life every day, as the old hymn writer said. "Have thine own way, Lord, have thine own way. Thou art the potter, I'm just the clay." Oh, Adelaide Pollard was right when she said that, didn't she? I'm just the clay, but he's the potter. And if you leave your life in his hands, he'll mold and he'll shape the clay. And if you take nothing out of this message this morning, take this: God's in control. He can be trusted. And bow your head and simply say this: "Lord, I'm fed up trying to control my life my way. I want you to take over. I want you to guide. You're in charge. And I trust your wisdom to know what's best for me." And you know, if you say that and mean that and act upon that, you'll be able to say, like King David said, at the end of his life, as for God, his way is the perfect way. Let us pray. Father, we thank thee for this thy word this morning. We thank thee that it's so helpful. If we can just come before you and lay our problems, our ambitions, our plans, or even our confusion, and say, "Lord, you just lead. You just guide. We trust you to open the door at the right time, to close the door at the right time that needs closed, and to just lead and guide and direct my life." And then we'll be able to say like the psalmist, "As for God, his way is perfect." Lead your people. Lead your child wherever he or she is this morning, in whatever decision they need your help. For we ask these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.